Welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday, the actuality news show, offering unique insights and in-depth analysis featuring South Africa's top business leaders, newsmakers, and analysts for today's professionals. Your host, Jeremy Mads.
Hello and welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday. I'm Jeremy Mags, and over the next 30 minutes, I'll bring you the latest headlines from South Africa and around the globe. Whether you're tuning in live or catching the podcast later, stay with us for in-depth conversation with leading business minds, political influencers, and key newsmakers. It's everything you need to stay informed, quick, sharp, and straight to the point. It's Wednesday, the 9th of October. Coming up, the economic impact of the conflict in the Middle East, why we are failing as a country when it comes to food waste management, the big executive pay debate, new rules to stir the pot, and exactly where vehicle hijacking is most prevalent. Over a year into the conflict in the Middle East, and the Palestinian territories are nearing economic freefall amidst a historic humanitarian crisis in the Gaza Strip. Official data reveals that there's a 35% decline in real GDP in the first quarter of this year for the Palestinian territories overall, and that makes it the largest economic contraction on record. But obviously the impact is far wider than that, and I'm going to look at the issue now with Isaac Udendal from Old Mutual Wealth Investment. And Isaac, firstly then, geopolitical risk is increasing. That's a given. And understandably, I guess, world economies are on edge.
Yeah, we've moved into a much more uncertain world, you know, one of which is the Middle East, obviously Russia, Ukraine, and then just the fact that the US and China no longer see themselves as being friends, but rather as being competitors, I think has caused a major shift in the way that all nations now approach geopolitics and diplomacy.
So let's focus on a couple of aspects if we can. First of all, how significant in your opinion is the risk of major disruption to global oil supplies? And might we see a repeat of past oil shocks, or because of perhaps better risk management, is the world better prepared?
Yes, and unfortunately the humanitarian disaster kind of falls by the wayside and the rest of the world really just cares about oil and the oil price when it comes to the Middle East. Now, past oil shocks have been significant, but we really are now talking about back in the 1970s. There was obviously a period where the oil price rose tenfold in real terms following various wars and revolutions in the Middle East and oil embargoes and so on. And that was obviously a time when the world was much more dependent on oil. And then more recently, we saw when Russia invaded Ukraine, the oil price spiked all the way up to $130 a barrel. And that contributed, didn't cause, but it contributed to a major inflation surge worldwide. And of course, central banks responded to that with much, much higher interest rates. Today, I mean, the oil price is sort of hovering at around $80 a barrel, just below, which is not a catastrophic level by any means. And in fact, it's lower than it was a year ago. And if you look at a chart, the oil price over the last 3 years has really been moving in a range of, you know, somewhere between $75 and $95 a barrel. So we're still well within that range. And in fact, before this latest round of escalations, in other words, before Iran fired those missiles into Israel and oil traders started panicking, the oil price was actually quite low. It was at the low end of that range, sort of in the low 70s. Fundamentally, it does look like the oil market is actually oversupplied, not undersupplied. There's concerns about slowing growth in China and so on, and also talk that Saudi Arabia was prepared to actually forego production cuts and start increasing oil supply in order to gain market share. So prior to this escalation, the oil market actually looked like it was quite bearish territory, and in fact this latest escalation was a bit of a reprieve. So, long story short, at this stage, no, it doesn't look like we're at risk of a major oil shock, but obviously it will depend on the next steps in this conflict.
You spoke about central bank intervention in the past and to counter the threat of rising inflation. But if things ratchet up, do you think this could delay global efforts to control inflation?
See, again, it depends, which unfortunately is a typical economist answer. Central banks look at what they call the second round effect. So they don't respond directly to what the oil price does up or down. What they look at is whether businesses are passing on higher costs to consumers. And in that sense, you get a sustaining inflation spiral, which was the case, by the way, when Russia invaded Ukraine. But that's kind of the data that they will be looking for. So no, in the short term, it's hard to say that this is going to fundamentally change the interest rate outlook for any country. And in fact, the oil price today is still lower than it was a year ago. So from a headline inflation point of view, we're still looking at a negative contribution from fuel across most countries rather than a positive contribution.
But if things change, and is that given our reliance on oil imports, we are or will find ourselves inevitably in a more vulnerable position, surely?
Yeah, unfortunately, South Africa is very reliant on international oil, and therefore the both the oil price and the exchange rate matter quite a lot. And it matters, as you said, for our import bill, and it matters also for inflation and the cost of living in general. So yeah, we are exposed. There's no way around it. Electric vehicle adoption in South Africa is still very, very low. So definitely this is something to keep an eye on. As I said, we don't know. We can speculate, but we don't know what the next steps are and how Israel responds and whether Iran retaliates again or ratchets up the conflict or tries to calm things down. You know, that is all speculation.
Now, let's move from oil to the rand if we can. The volatility, perhaps, as far as our currency is concerned, has tempered slightly in the past couple of months, but still is sensitive to global risk sentiment. So what impact, if any, could this directly have on the rand's performance, given that volatility that we have spoken about?
Yeah, I think at this stage, the rand is sensitive to kind of shifts in risk appetite, and it has been a bit weaker the last couple of days, partly in response to this conflict. But I think the bigger driver at this stage is more expectations of U.S. interest rates. And what we've seen in the last week is actually stronger U.S. economic data, stronger employment data, and therefore investors have scaled back their expectations for interest rate cuts. The dollar has been a bit firmer. And that's, I think, the main reason why the rand has lost a bit of ground over the last few days. But we must also say that the rand had a very strong rally, and typically, when you know there's been a nice rally like that, people take profit and they reassess their positions, and things take a breather. Markets never move in a straight line.
Besides oil, that we've spent some time talking about, this conflict surely is going to influence other key commodities, such as gold and other precious metals.
Yeah, I mean, gold has been, I think, the big winner. But again, I think gold is probably the winner, not necessarily for this conflict, but just a changing geopolitical picture. And that includes the fact that countries like Russia and China are maybe trying to diversify their reserve holdings away from U.S. dollar-based assets into gold. So I think that has been one part of the story. Typically, gold also does well when interest rates fall. So I think that's been another part of the story. So it's all a sort of a mix of factors that go into something like the gold price, and not necessarily just the fact that we saw missiles flying over the last few days.
I'm going to leave it there with my deep appreciation. Isaac Odendaal from Old Mutual Wealth, always good talking to you, and thank you so much.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
Now, in the latest crime data compiled by Tracker, hijackings now make up 54% of all vehicle crime incidents in this country, with business vehicles being significantly at more risk. I'm in conversation now with Duma Ngobo, who's Chief Operating Officer at Tracker. Duma, welcome. Thank you very much indeed. Are there key or new reasons behind the rise in hijackings?
Yes, thank you for having me, Jeremy, and your listeners. We obviously, you've mentioned the 54% of hijackings. This is driven by a lot of advances in vehicle technology. We must remember that vehicle crime largely is driven by opportunity. And what a would-be criminal wants to be able to do is to get in and into your vehicle and drive away as quickly as reasonably possible. And therefore, we do tend to see vehicle hijackings being predominantly higher.
The trends themselves, is there a difference now between personal and business vehicles? And if I read the data correctly, business vehicles are that much more targeted. But I guess that's probably inevitable, isn't it?
Yes, to a large extent. I think if you go back to COVID, that changed the vehicle crime landscape significantly. We saw a lot of courier type vehicles. We saw a lot of e-hailing vehicles kind of growing. And that's changed the pattern of crime on the one hand. But again, your courier vehicles are targeted sort of what we call the pavement hijacking as it stops at the entrance of a business or of a house to deliver goods and services. We do tend to see that happening a lot more. So business vehicles are a lot more at risk nowadays. And that's just one example that we can point to.
Is there a specific reason as to why the Eastern Cape has become such a high-risk area?
Yeah, that was of particular interest for us because historically, your major provinces or your larger provinces, as it would be, Gauteng, KZN, and Western Cape, were where we used to see our crime patterns distributed sort of along those lines. And that follows the immigration patterns. The N2 along the Eastern Cape is an interesting one for us because we've seen a significant spike. Other than your sort of opportunistic element where a vehicle turns over and the load is then ransacked by the community, we're also seeing quite sophisticated criminals, blue light robberies, using sophisticated signal jammers and the like to stop trucks on the route and take high value goods, as it were.
I don't know how deeply you mine this information, but Gauteng accounts for close on 60% of all vehicle crime. I guess that is understandable. But do you break it down as to which areas specifically in the province are most at risk?
Yes, we do. So we would look at it predominantly at a provincial level. Because what we don't want to do, we need to be very responsible around not creating panic. So, you know, we do look at the suburbs. So naturally, your Pretoria, your northern suburbs, your Sandtons, your Buccleuch, your Four Ways kind of area tend to exhibit very significant and sharp hijacking and theft rates. We also see schools in those particular areas are a significant attraction for your criminals. So we do tend to see those patterns as well.
Is there a time of the day and week when vehicles are most at risk?
Yeah, that's an interesting one. So your Thursday and Friday, say after 4 p.m., all the way to about nowadays, 8 to 10 p.m. on a Friday evening, we tend to see a spike in your hijacking rates, whereas your Saturdays tend to present more preponderance of sort of theft rates. And that's largely because people are at places of leisure, your malls, your schools for sport events, and the vehicles left alone for a period of time, allowing your criminals to then get into your vehicle and steal it away.
And the criminals themselves are adapting their methods, particularly in Gauteng, the concept of keyless entry relay attacks. Maybe just explain that to me. And again, are they becoming more adept? Are they one step ahead of the process, do you think?
Yeah, so I don't want to belittle the topic. It does tend to be a bit of a cat and mouse game between ourselves, other law enforcement, and the criminals. But to answer your question pointedly, your relay is basically a signal between your key fob and your vehicle receiver. And there's a message in between, or a handshake, as we call it. What tends to happen is that they've got tools that can intercept the signal and re-encode it onto a completely separate key. So your keyless entry vehicles, as much as it's a convenience factor for the owner, it has placed a bit of a risk where the criminals, you'll see them maybe with a big briefcase or a bag, and that's really got a receiver and a distributor between somebody who's close to you and the vehicle itself, and they intercept the signal and they can get into your vehicle relatively quickly. There are other methods, but that's the simplest way to sort of explain it.
Thank you very much indeed. Duma Ngobo is Chief Operating Officer at Tracker. Appreciate your time.
Thank you.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
Now, the debate around executive pay is heating up, with new rules set to shake things up in the corporate world. Recent changes, including the company's amendment bill and updates to the JSE listing requirements, are pushing for more transparency, fairness and accountability in executive remuneration. Joining me now is Dr. Chris Blair, who's Chief Executive Officer of the remuneration and rewards company 21st Century. Chris, welcome. And are businesses, in your opinion, prepared for the shift?
Sure, Jeremy. Look, it's quite a big shift, specifically worldwide. So there are actually four elements to it, very broadly. The first one's the biggest one, where up till now there's been a vote on the remuneration policy that has been non-binding. In other words, if the shareholders go to the AGM, vote on the remuneration policy and vote it down, and it was 75% plus one. If you missed that, you voted it down. The company, there was no direct consequence in terms of a binding outcome. They did need to engage with shareholders, but they could feasibly just continue doing what they were doing. So this change has meant that now it's a binding vote. So if the remuneration policy or remuneration report gets a fail on the binding vote, which now is 50% plus one, which is a bit obviously easier, then effectively the remuneration policy, the previous one, holds until they get a binding vote on that policy and for the implementation report. So that's a big one, because if they fail twice, the remuneration committee members have to stand down, and they have to, they cannot re-stand for the next 2 years. So that's got a huge implication for businesses. The other ones are more about disclosure, which is becoming much more transparent and kind of detailed. So they have to now declare the single figure remuneration for all directors and prescribed officers in detail every single year by name. And then in terms of the rest of the employees, they have to report the top, the highest salary versus the bottom or the lowest salary, and then the average and median of the salaries. Mm. And lastly, they have to report the top 5% versus the bottom 5% wage gap. So this really homes in on increasing shareholder involvement, but then also fair and transparent disclosure of executive salaries versus the rest of the salaries.
Chris, I suppose it does beg the question as to why remuneration committees broadly have been on the back foot in the past.
Yeah, I think like anything, Jeremy, you know, people report the stuff that they have to from a legislative point of view. And now it's been sort of flushed out, where remuneration committees have to, come to the table and make sure that they're not having the wool pulled over their eyes in any way by the executives, and that they actually are the remuneration practices are fair and responsible in terms of, you know, where the company is.
So do you think that it's going to be difficult to hold those remuneration committees to account, or do you think that it's human nature and that executives will continue to try at least to play hard and fast?
Look, I think there will still be that, but I think that the jaws are coming in quite quickly. So I think the wiggle room is getting less and less and less. So what organizations will have to do is make sure that their remuneration policy and remuneration reports, which is the implementation report, are very easy to read, very transparent, because the shareholders are coming in to vote on their feet. They are not remuneration experts. They're going to be looking at it in terms of just, do we think this is fair? Does it make sense? Does it engender what the company's strategic objectives are? Is there a long, medium, short, medium, and long-term view on it? And if they get that sense from the remuneration report, then they'll probably vote in favor. And that's where the company will have to go. So this is a bit of a dancing act because the detail that they're requiring requires specialist knowledge, yet it has to be translated into something that shareholders can easily understand and get that feeling of comfort that this company is actually being fair, transparent, and responsible.
Chris, we're speaking about all of this procedurally, but there's also a moral aspect to this. In other words, doing the right thing. And King 4, and I think it's Principle 14, focuses on what
Correct.
Is termed fair and responsible pay. Do you think that South African companies are truly aligning executive pay with performance and, more importantly, company values?
Yes, so there's been a great move in that direction, Jeremy, over the last, I would say, 10 years, and specifically at executive level because they're in the sort of limelight. And the link between the short-term incentive and long-term incentive objectives that the company now has to actually put into their remuneration reports, they have to show the link back to the payouts. So that gives some comfort in terms of that the link is there. What you're alluding to, the moral crisis, is the quantums. So the link can be very, very securely there, and the executive deserves to earn X amount of money. But the scaling, and as you know, the Gini coefficient is the worst in the world. So those, the ratio between the top and the bottom, that's where it has to be worked upon. It probably isn't the solution to try to reduce the top or to cap it, but rather to raise the bottom. So there's a lot of move in companies that hasn't got into the Companies Act amendment yet in terms of a living wage, not even a fair wage, but what is a living wage? So companies are starting to go down that track, putting living wage policies in place and trying to take the moral standpoint of, yes, we've got our executives, we do have to remunerate them to retain them, attract them, motivate them, but we've got a greater responsibility to try to raise the lower wages to a living wage. So that's quite a big change that's moving in South Africa now.
Let me ask you one final question, and what does your gut tell you? Do you think these changes are going to lead to fairer executive pay structures, or do you think that there are still deeper, maybe systemic issues that still need to be addressed before we get this right?
Yeah, very good question, Jeremy. So one of the reasons that they, from a legislative point of view, have said, okay, you need to declare all these salaries in detail so that everyone can see them. So it's kind of a bit along the lines of, let's shame and blame. If you see that there's excess, there's greed, there isn't linked to performance or whatever. The unintended consequence has been that obviously all the executives can look across the fence just by opening the remuneration report and then saying, hang on, that executive earns this, I'm earning that. So, you need to, so they call it the ratcheting. So that executive says, well, I need to get paid more because I'm doing equivalent job to that other executive in that other company. So there has been a ratcheting of executive pay because of disclosure. So it's a double-edged sword. If you don't disclose it, then there's uncertainty, lack of transparency. But if you disclose it, it kind of means that everyone can try to, what's right word, join the race, if I can call it that.
All right. Really is a conundrum, but I'm going to leave it there. But thank you so much, Dr. Chris Blair, Chief Executive Officer of the Remuneration and Rewards Company, 21st Century. Thank you very much.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
And finally on the program, new data shows that millions of South Africans are food insecure, with an estimated 1 in 5 households not knowing where their next meal will come from. Now, as part of its sustainable development goals, our government has committed to halving food waste by 2030. But I guess the question, are we on track to achieve this goal? Mamohala Musekeni is the Deputy Director General of Chemical and Waste Management at the Department of Forestry, Fisheries and Environment. She spoke at the Impact Summit held here in Johannesburg yesterday and joins me on the program now. So what do you see, and welcome to you, what do you see are the primary reasons behind the high levels of food waste?
Our production processes are not optimal and efficient, and we have noted that from primary production in our farms, there is some loss that happens, but also at harvesting and processing, the food loss and waste is also happening, including post-retail at our households as well as part of food preparations. And the other issue that we've noted at household level is that the labeling in terms of the best before date or expiry date has been raised as an issue by consumers. So we have worked with the Department of Health to ensure that the standard with regard to labeling is also reviewed just to promote and make consumers aware.
All right, let's talk about labeling in just a moment. But in terms of improving process, this seems to me as if it's a problem right up and down the value chain. Is there a specific weak link that could be focused on?
Depending on, you know, the part of the value chain where you are, you know, you just need to take a deep dive into the cost. For example, if you look at post-harvesting and before processing, there could be a cold chain that needs to be maintained. And we had challenges with load shedding affecting, you know, the refrigeration. So depending specifically on the issue at hand, then specific interventions can be employed to assist.
What type of interventions would we be talking about, and that would that sit within the remit of your department?
So we have looked at various interventions, and I've mentioned earlier on that, okay, there are labeling issues, and that sits outside my department because the legislation that is looking at administration of foodstuffs, it's under the Department of Health. So we work collaboratively with the Department of Health to take care of that aspect. But my department comes in as part of maybe managing when the waste has been generated, but in terms of our legal powers. But because we take a value chain approach, that's why we are working with stakeholders upstream of the value chain as part of, you know, our preventative efforts and to reduce the food that will then become waste if interventions are not taken.
And yet we still have a problem. It would seem to me that this multi-sectorial collaboration is not necessarily working well.
I think we are raising awareness and building capacity on specific aspects and ensuring that we have stakeholders that appreciate the food recovery hierarchy, and we have various stakeholders that work at different levels. I'll give an example. The summit that we just had yesterday that was hosted by Danone, they work mainly at source reduction. But we do have other stakeholders, your civil society, NGOs that work on food recovery. So they make sure that they get information of the surplus in food that is available, and they are able to work with their networks to donate and feed the hungry people. But we also have the industry that also is part of recovering the energy from the food waste that has been generated, using that for energy production, biogas, but also composting. If the food waste is there, we are also preventing it from getting to the landfill, and it goes into recycling, and it's part of what is used to produce composting.
There is a government commitment to halving food waste within the next 5 years. It would seem to me that we are way off track in meeting this target.
We are working on it, part of Sustainable Development Goal 12, as part of the measures that the Department of Environment is implementing. It's responding to our National Waste Management Strategy. And hence, when I talk about the upstream interventions, it's working with the retailers because some of the specifications or the standard in terms of assessing whether the food can go on to retail, it's just about aesthetics. But now there is a review process to say it can go into other aspects of the value chain if it doesn't have to be about its appearance.
I do understand what you're saying, but realistically, we are not going to meet this goal by 2030, are we?
Realistically, there are interventions that are in place and is a mission for us as the department and with other departments that also have a role to play. Because from our side, of course, if we don't take these interventions, we are seeing environmental impacts that are associated. That's why we're talking about waste, and there are other negative impacts that are associated. Hence, working with stakeholders upstream in the value chain where we're still talking about the production to ensure that there's optimization and efficiency measures are in place.
Mamo Khala Musekene, thank you very much indeed, Deputy Director General Chemical Waste Management at the Department of Forestry. I appreciate your time. Thank you so much. And that is our program for today. On our online poll, we spoke about this a little earlier. In fact, our lead story, the economic impact of the Middle East crisis. I'd like your view on that. We're feeling it already, or in your opinion, is it going to worsen? If you have a view, you can participate either on X or on LinkedIn. And that's where we are going to leave it. MoneyWeb at Midday is live at noon weekdays. We're then up as a podcast. Thank you for listening and goodbye.
Listen to the daily live stream of MoneyWeb at Midday or download episodes on moneyweb.co.za, the MoneyWeb app, Apple Podcasts and Spotify, or follow MoneyWeb News on social media for more updates. MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.